Guy. Dog had some type of whooping cough yesterday, so he was late to work, but
Uh-oh.
some kennel cough or
Are we
something.
ready, guys?
I'm born ready.
All right. I call this Human Services Committee meeting to order on Tuesday, March 7th at 6:01 p.m. And we've already done the roll call. Everyone is here. Supervisor Gjertsen is excused. Are there any citizen comments? Citizens' comments? Citizens' comments? Seeing none, citizens' comments are closed. Because I know we have a lengthy presentation, I'm not going to make any comments myself tonight. Are there any other comments from committee members? Any other supervisors in the room? Youth and governance? Okay, moving on to Kenosha County DCFS Child Protective Services.
Okay, well, thank you.
Welcome again.
You're welcome.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me again. Appreciate it. So I know, Chairperson Edweski asked me to come back and just give sort of a more of a in-depth look at how do we do the work we do in Child Protective Services. So I've sent, you should have all received a PowerPoint. And if there's some of you who would like a paper copy of that, you know, back to back, we have a few paper copies here if you'd like that. You can pass that out. But I'll just jump right into it. So the underpinnings of what we do, the three focuses are safety, permanence, and well-being. And these are concepts that were codified into federal law in 1997 with the adoption of Safe Families Act. So safety is child safety, free from physical abuse, sexual abuse, physical neglect. There's other areas of abuse like emotional abuse, but really it's those three top ones that I just spoke to you about. The other thing is we're getting involved in children's lives to improve their well-being. And well-being is a very broad concept. So it's physical health, mental health, dental health, but also how are they doing in school? Are they in school? How are they doing within the family? How are they doing in the community? So they're not, you know, are they functioning well? And permanence was a concept that came out. It has a specific meaning in child welfare. And what it means is, well, if you take children away from their parents because they have been victims of child abuse and neglect and it's unsafe for them to be at home, you have to be focused on finding a permanent, safe home for every child in foster care. So those are the three underpinnings: safety, permanence, and well-being. And then slide two. So the main work that we do in Child Protective Services is what we call primary assessments. And that's where the alleged maltreatment has occurred in the parent's home. So those are all so it's a guardian, legal custodian of the child. We do investigate a teacher who may have allegedly maltreated a child, or a camp counselor, or a daycare provider. But if you think of our main focus of work, our main focus is, are children being abused in their home? If they are being abused, who is abusing them? And then are the safety threats that are ongoing? Why is this abuse occurring? And then what do we need to do to provide services, help, assistance to that family so that that abuse ends and children are safe in their home, and so that the parents are doing a better job raising their kids and their well-being improves. So that's really the focus of Child Protective Services. Now, we can work hand in hand with law enforcement in this, and when we have severe abuse, parents are charged with crimes, but that's handled in criminal court. And we're going to talk really about child abuse and neglect, which is handled in juvenile court. Okay, so slide three. So we talked about this just briefly last time I was here in December. We get multiple reports every day about child abuse and neglect. A supervisor has to read all of those reports. That's in the first column, CPS reports. They determine if that meets the state standards to be screened in. They also determine if there are safety threats in the verbal telephone call we receive. That determines how fast we have to go out. And then they assign it to an initial assessment worker. Law enforcement is contacted in all allegations of sexual abuse. law enforcement's contacted when there's any allegation of severe abuse. And law enforcement can be contacted anywhere during the initial assessment if we learn more about it and it seems like there's been crimes committed or we're going to need their assistance in this work. So the initial, the next column over, initial assessment interview contacts. So this social worker, we call them an initial assessment worker, they're going to interview everybody in the home. So if this is a blended family where there's a mom and a dad and three kids, and there's a grandma and grandpa living there, and maybe there is an aunt living there too, they literally are going to interview everybody who could verbally talk and be interviewed. They're going, if the child is too young to be interviewed, they will absolutely see every child in the home. And then, and they will absolutely go to the home and look at the physical home. Are there safety threats in the home? Is the home deplorable? Is it horribly dirty? Are there maybe wiring threats or just the way it's a poor, unkept home and there's exposed wires or there's something that it can harm a child? And then the next bullet there, face-to-face contact is required with the following individuals. So when they saw, what's saying is identified child, that's the child that when the phone call came in is identified of being abused or neglected. Then any sibling to that child. If there's two home parents, two families living together in the same home, we're not just interviewing one family, we're going to interview every kid that lives in that home because there's probably co-parenting going on. Parents are responsible for more than one child. We're going to interview every adult in that home, and we're going to eventually interview the alleged maltreater. We usually interview that person last. Why do we interview that person last? Most people don't, if you just start with the alleged maltreater, they probably aren't going to tell you the truth when you start with them, if they have harmed a child. And you don't want to talk to an adult first. If you have verbal children, you want to talk to a child first. So it's very common, if they're school age, that we will go out and interview kids within the school because we don't want a parent. We started with the adults, then the parent may turn to the adults and say, hey, don't talk to those people. Or, you know, your dad really didn't hit you that hard, so you shouldn't really, you know, let's not talk to them. So you try to start with the verbal children first, in whatever setting they're in. Collateral contacts, we always have some. So there, it could be a teacher, could be the daycare provider, could be a neighbor or extended family members. And then last thing is, as we're doing this work, we're assessing child safety. Every time we talk to a child, every time we talk to a parent, when we walk in the home, we're looking for what we call safety threats. And that's the work of the initial assessment worker.
I have a couple questions on this one.
Yeah. Okay.
So, very first bullet point is receives a report, and we talked a little bit about this in December. Who is calling in reports primarily?
Schools.
Schools. Okay.
And medical providers.
And daycare.
Daycare is right under that.
Okay. And in terms of entering the home, and you're in this initial assessment process. Is there at any point where you are not going in the home or you have to stop because they're saying you can't come in?
Generally, we get into every home eventually.
But is a person allowed to say you can't come in?
If the report is screened in, they can say we can't come in, and then we'll contact law enforcement or other people to eventually get in the home. But I think the biggest thing to remember in this is we're not coming in like a police on a drug raid.
Right.
We're trying to build rapport, and we're trying to get in the home to work with these parents. So if someone says no today, we will say to them, well, we need to get in here, but I'm going to be interviewing, you know, I have other children to interview, but I'll be back tomorrow. And that's how we work that.
Do you face resistance often?
No, you know, I think we have good staff that are pretty well trained, and they're usually able to get. The focus is child safety. And if you remember the last time we met, we're investigating in a year somewhere between 750, 850 allegations of abuse. let's say the number is 750. 680, there will not have been abuse in that home. There's 70 out of 750 mm-hmm. that are going to get transferred over to the ongoing services unit. Yeah.
I think I often get a question about how come child protect, like, how come they didn't go in the house? They went there, but they didn't go in the house.
No, they, that's...
And I'm like, I don't know.
No, they will eventually get in the home. Because we're required to, and we do.
But you're also allowed to interview children.
Well, that's what we talked about the last time I was here. Once you screen this in, you can do. You can have. You can. You don't need parents' permission to interview their kids,
right?
Or see their kids at a daycare, or contact the child's medical provider. So it really depends on the allegation, mm-hmm. right? So what is the allegation? The allegation is that it's a. Child that's not cared for and they're dirty and unkept, but they go to daycare. Well, we're going to see that child in daycare. We're going to interview the daycare provider. And, you know, how is this child showing up at daycare when their parent drops them off? Are their parents ever late? Things like that. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in a neighborhood where there were a lot of situations where child protective services were called, and you'd have parents who told their kids, you don't let anyone in the door.
Yeah.
And oftentimes there wasn't anything happening. It was that I'm a single mom, and I don't have time to keep my house clean. Mm-hmm. And if someone comes in here, they're going to determine that it's an unsafe place because we haven't been able to keep it up. You know, is that a real threat?
No. Not if it's just a messy, cluttered, you know. I mean, everybody's home gets, you know, messy. There aren't always dishes done every night, things like that. What we're really seeing, what the allegations, what we see in abuse and neglect is really severe maltreatment. I mean, like, the home is deplorable.
Okay.
You know, plumbing isn't working, toilets aren't flushing, bags of garbage, you know, large hefty bags of garbage that never got taken out. Or what you sometimes get is a parent brings a child into the emergency room with a serious injury, and they don't have a good reason for that injury. And the child is so young that it's really unlikely the child would have ever injured themselves that way in play or any type of normal activity. So that's going to be a call coming in. So let me go to slide four.
Quick question. When you talk about all allegations of sexual abuse are, you know, turned over to the police, what about obvious drug use?
No, that's not necessarily turned over to the police.
Okay.
No. Good question. Okay. Yeah. So when we're meeting everybody, these are the big things we're looking at. We want to figure out, did maltreatment occur? And if it did, or something, you know, what were the circumstances around it? We're also trying to get a sense of how are these children, you know, where are they developmentally? Is this five-year-old acting like a typical five-year-old, or are there developmental delays? Is this 10-year-old, you know, in regular ed at school, or maybe are they in special education? We're even getting to the level of asking a parent, does your child have an IEP? Things like that. For the adult functioning, general functioning, how do they run their lives? Are they employed? Are they receiving benefits? Do they seem to be... when we interview them, do they seem to be mentally in a good state of mind, emotionally, like an average person? We're asking specific questions on how they parent their kids, not just discipline, but what is the routine like at home? You know, is there a bedtime routine? Is there a meal routine? How do you show affection? We're trying to get a real look at that, and we're also assessing family functioning, meaning, how does this family as a whole run itself in its home? And if it's a blended family, which is because maybe there isn't a lot of money and you have two families living together, then, you know, how do you divvy up responsibilities between the adults? Okay? Then we have something, we've had it here in Kenosha County for, what, 18 years now, I think, the Kenosha County Child Advocacy Center. And so during this initial assessment, it's called, our primary focus now is safety. Has a child been maltreated? Are the children safe in the home? And if we think, or there is more and more evidence that children have been maltreated, there's all these signs that something is amiss, we can work with law enforcement and have children seen at the Kenosha County Child Advocacy Center. Children can get a full child abuse assessment there, which includes a medical exam and what they call a forensic interview, where older children who are verbal, they'll ask questions of the children like we would in the field, but they'll record it on a DVD. Why do they do that? Because if the crime of child abuse has been committed, it is better for children not to relive that and testify about it more than once. So if you can get a good, solid interview that's recorded, then often that can be used in prosecuting the maltreater. And often maltreaters, when they know that there's this solid evidence, then they may agree to a plea deal as opposed to fighting it, you know. So, and then if I'll go one more slide, slide five. So slide five, six, and seven talk about what are we assessing for present danger. So I'm just gonna highlight a couple of these on each slide, things that come up more often. So a sign of present danger for us is a child in a family has, number three, has multiple or different kinds of injuries. That is, they don't just have a bruise on their arm. There's a bruise on their leg and the bruise in the back of their neck. So either they got into a really odd accident or someone was maybe hitting them or striking them with an object. Another one is a child has an injury to the face or head. So you, especially with younger children, that's almost always serious. So, because you can do severe damage to a child if you hit them in the face or the head. Unexplained injuries, number five. You know, the child has this big mark on their arm and no one can tell you how they got that or where that came from. And then the next page, six, number 11, is that child is unsupervised, unable to care for self. That's the call that comes in at night from a neighbor, and they say, I think the toddler is home alone. I don't think there's a parent in the house. And we get calls like that, and that is something we're gonna call law enforcement because we need to get in that home and figure out if that child is indeed home alone and how old that child is, right? The other one that can happen is number 14. I see the mom, she's home with these kids. I saw her, she just looked drunk as a skunk when she walked in the door, and I'm the neighbor and I'm calling about that. Or there's something else that makes them think they're intoxicated now, and the caller thinks they're the only caregiver for those children right now. And the other present danger threats on page 7 of the slide, you know, number 19 is one where, again, the children are home alone and nobody has a clue where the parents are, or the reports are the home is really deplorable, as if there isn't any parent doing any basic parenting in that home. So those are things that when we get those, present danger means we need to take action that day to help those kids be in a safe situation. And then the other sets of danger threats, and we'll jump into how we make kids safe, but number 8 is impending danger. So sometimes you don't walk into present danger, you walk into these allegations, and you're on day 2 or 3 of your initial assessment, and you're learning more about the parents, you're learning more about how they run their household, and what's coming out of that is that you start to realize there's impending danger. And number 3 is a great example of that. The parents, when you first see them on the first day, they're not intoxicated or high, but number 3 means they may have a drug or substance abuse problem, or they have untreated mental health issues, they're not controlling their behavior, and suddenly on day 3, they are altered and they don't look like themselves, and now you've talked to other people involved with the family and they say, well, mom's got a, you know, she uses pot daily, or she uses this daily, and she's really got a substance use problem. The other thing is, as you get in the home, you realize there isn't any routine. No adult is really performing parental duties. It's unclear who is responsible for the children. Slide 9. Number 8 and 9 are somewhat common. Number 8 is with some of our younger parents. Some of our younger parents they were raised in homes where they were not raised very well, and they have really a lack of basic understanding and knowledge. You know, the what I'm talking about is they think the 6-year-old can supervise the 4-year-old and the 2-year-old and be left in charge of the house, things like that, where they just don't even, they're not even thinking at all developmentally that a little 6-year-old can watch a 4-year-old. They can't, but they sometimes think they can, or they think that maybe they have a child with exceptional needs, and they're just they're not able to manage those needs. So either we see present danger usually right away, or within a day or two we're realizing we have impending danger. And if you go to slide 10, then the next part of that is we've identified present or impending danger. That's on the danger threats column. We have to do either a protective plan or a safety plan. And I won't get into the technicalities of the differences between the two, but we have to do something that day to make that a safe situation. So using an example where you have a drug abusing parent and little toddler age, like a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old in the home, and that drug abusing parent, maybe they have a partner, and that partner does not appear to be drug abusing, and we're still gathering our information. A protective plan might be you, the drug abusing parent that have been stoned, when I've seen you, you have to leave the home right now. You have to promise me you'll leave the home. You, the parent that seems to be straight and sober, who is another adult that is a good resource for us to move into your home for a few days? And I have a program that's going to check on this living situation for the next 5 days while I finish my initial assessment. And they're going to randomly come out to make sure that the drug abusing parent is not coming back in the home, that the sober adult is going to be there while I continue to figure out what else is going on in this home and what else this family needs. When parents agree to that, it's all documented as a written plan. It's signed off. Our supervisor has to approve that and say, yes, we can, that makes sense. We can manage safety. We're not solving the problem. We're just managing the safety threat while we gather more information. And then we operate with that plan. Now, we're still doing our initial assessment, which is a term for an investigation. And if you go to page 11, so then if that plan is working, we have this resource like in-home safety services going out to that home multiple times daily to manage that plan. We have a very tight review of that plan once every 2 weeks. The workers paying attention to that plan, and we're adjusting if it's needed while we still are gathering the information. Or we start the plan and immediately realize this isn't going to work. I don't have good compliance with these parents. Or at the very beginning, I only have one parent. It's a single parent household. And they don't have any relatives that appear to be any better parents than this person who is high and intoxicated. And so then we still have a safety threat. So if we cannot use an in-home safety plan, if we cannot use a protective plan, then we're going to request to have these kids removed legally through a temporary physical custody order. And that's where the column says juvenile court intake. So the social worker and their supervisor below the or there have said, this isn't working, you know, or it's not going to work. We don't even attempt the plan. And instead, we move right to placement into out-of-home care. And then we have to take all those safety threats that we've identified and what the alleged maltreatment is. We contact juvenile court intake, separate department from us. They then give the legal authorization for to take, they approve our request for temporary physical custody. They prepare legal court documents that are passed out to the parents. And we are busy finding a placement for each of these kids in the home. If we can find a sober, straight, upstanding relative, and by that I mean we literally do background checks on the fly through our computers. We're doing a CCAP check, we're doing a sex offender check, we're doing a CPS records check because all the CPS records are now on a computer. And this adult relative appears to be upstanding. And when we go out to the home, they're living in a decent home, we can place that kid temporarily with a relative, or we're gonna call one of our foster homes. And then I say their initial assessment worker or resource development, we have a contract, resource development and recruitment with community impact programs. They license and manage our foster home group. And so we have a placement phone. We call them and say, we need, I have a placement for two kids. And as much information as we can share on a phone call, we say, you know, I have a 3 and a 5-year-old and they need homes tonight. We can find one home for both, that'd be great. We can't, they can't stay with this in this unsafe situation. So that's how kids get into foster care. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a reason for all these different groups' involvement rather than having it a little more streamlined?
What do you mean by streamlined?
Juvenile intake versus CPS.
Yeah, it's like there's all these groups that
Well, what do you mean by groups? Because I'm not sure.
Yeah, CPS, juvenile court.
Well, the only group right now is CPS. We don't have the legal authority to place children in care.
Okay, so that's a state or a federal issue?
No, that's Kenosha County's preference. Okay. All the judges love juvenile court intake.
Okay.
They like court-attached intake.
Okay. It just seems like there's several
Well, that's really two.
Silos.
There's two.
I should have written them down, but going through it just seemed like there was a few.
So do they ever deny your request for a temporary physical custody order?
Sure, they can. Then we'll put together an in-home safety plan or protective plan.
What would be the terms of denial?
I would, they would say that it is not emergent enough. Yeah. We are one of four counties that have juvenile court intake. As opposed to it being less streamlined or more obstacles, we view it really 100% different, Supervisor Stocker.
Okay.
We view them as another set of eyes and ears to review the same information and give us their opinion on what's going on with this family. And so we don't view it as a roadblock, but actually as a partner in our work. We're not arguing with them. They're following safety standards.
Yeah.
What they're following
seems like another step in the process that takes time. That would be my perception.
Somebody has to do it.
Okay.
And so if they don't do it in their office, then there has to be somebody else in the human services building that does it. It's a legal step. So there isn't any way. Our staff will never have a social worker will never have the authority on their own to do that. There has to be somebody at a higher level to grant that authority. So whether that is the staff of juvenile court intake, or whether that's the equivalent of the staff of juvenile court intake that are not out in the field, that are in the human services building or at the police department or somewhere, somebody has to grant that authority. So it's not a step that can be missed, I guess is what I'm saying. The protective plan of a parent saying, I voluntarily will let my children go to my sister's house because my house is horrible, we could do something like that, but we have no legal authority over those children. And therefore that parent could just say, well, I changed my mind, and they're back. So to make it legal so that the courts are now involved, that's why you have to have, somebody has to have intake authority. So Kenosha chooses to have the intake authority attached to the judiciary, to the courthouse.
Okay.
Some counties choose to give it to a different department in human services.
So up until this point, you're still in this initial assessment process, you're figuring out if dangers are emergent or not. We might try a plan. We might forego a plan altogether. Supervisor Stocker brought up earlier if there's any evidence of drug use. I suppose that if you're not witnessing it happening, it could be, you know, an impending danger.
Right.
But at what point, when is law enforcement involved and when are they not? You know, in this assessment process,
well,
you're not witnessing anything necessarily like happening in process.
They're almost always involved when we're placing kids into foster care, because usually at that point, one of the parents is not happy with that, so we've called them. They're involved. If we're witnessing where there's significant maltreatment and a severe injury, looks like, you know, that we're going to bring law enforcement in. If we have any trouble getting in the home, we're going to be contacting law enforcement. Yeah.
But if you're in a home and you see drug paraphernalia,
we can call law enforcement.
You can call law enforcement.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not ignoring that. Okay. We're not walking through and say, oh, look at that, you've got heroin, you know, because that is a safety threat, depending on the age of the kids, right? So needles, hard drugs laid out, all of that are safe.
I think there's sometimes a confusing perception from the public as to where is law enforcement's role and partnership with you, and, you know, when can they get involved and when they can't, and it's when you call.
When we call, we will call when everything that I've discussed so far,
so
are examples of that.
If you call, if someone calls the police department and says the toddler next door is home alone, what is law enforcement going to do?
They're probably going to rush out there, and they're going to call us on the way.
Okay.
And we're both going to show up. Yeah.
Okay.
Because we work very well with Kenosha Police Department and really well with the Kenosha Sheriff's Department and the other law enforcement entities in the county. We have a very good agreement with them. So we have something called a coordinated response to child abuse neglect, Supervisor Stocker, and this is an agreement that is signed by all the heads of every local law enforcement and our county executive and myself and the Child Advocacy Center and the heads of our local hospitals and the head of the local school districts, KUSD, and our after-hours response to Child Protective Services, Kenosha Human Development Services. We sign that agreement once a year, all the upper management sign it, and every month, middle management, like Pamela Condos or supervisors that report to her, meet with those entities to talk about how is the system working in Kenosha County and what can we do to improve it. So through that, we've developed things like a drug endangered children protocol. So when the police now go out to make a drug raid at a house, they used to just sort of do that on their own. If there were kids there, we'd find out about it after the effect. I have two social workers now in our CPS unit that can go out with the police with them, because they think there'll be kids in that home. So the police can do what they're going to do, which is arrest people who are selling drugs and get the drugs out of the home. And if there's toddlers there, our social worker is going to handle that part of it, the child welfare, the child protective service part of it. And literally, we have two staff that have gotten up early in the morning to be out there with the police, and they're going out to a home at, you know, they're there at 6:30 in the morning, and they're going to someone's home at 7 o'clock. And that is coming out of the coordination efforts. So we are we have a lot of services and parts, but they're not willy-nilly pointing the finger at each other, asking, what are you doing, what are you doing? We're extremely coordinated in Kenosha County. That's one of our strengths. And most counties don't have this coordinated response to child abuse that we have. Our district attorneys are part of that too, because they want to prosecute people who maltreat children, but they also prosecute our CHIPS cases, meaning our Children Needed Protection or Services cases are not referred to Corporation Counsel. That some counties do that work. In Kenosha County, the District Attorney's Office does that work, and there's ADAs that specialize in that work. Yeah. Okay,
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, what's the turnaround time? I believe you addressed this in the last in back in December, but what's the turnaround time between the CPS report and the initial assessment? And then also, what's the turnaround time from where you decide that, you know, you need to go to the juvenile? And, you know, what's the time frame between these two steps here between, on page 11? Between deciding that this needs to go to juvenile, and then what's that court process take? What's the time frame between those two?
Okay, we'll get into that court process a lot, because once you take kids into legal custody through a temporary physical custody order, the courts are involved in everything we do thereafter. So during the initial assessment, we're going out on those calls. If the allegation is such, we're going out the day we get the phone call, or within 48 hours of getting the phone call, up to 5 days. Depends on what the initial report is. Then we are, as we're out there, if you go interviewing the kids in the school and there are no marks or bruises on them and no one's saying they're maltreated, then we're going to interview other, you know, the rest of the kids. We're going to check with collateral contacts. We're going to get out to the home. At some point, whenever we see a present danger or impending danger, we have to take action that day to protect those kids. And so what it is if on day 10 we discover impending danger and the parents are not going to follow a safety plan, we're calling juvenile court intake. If on day 20 we discover impending danger and the parents aren't going to follow a safety plan, we're going to call juvenile court intake. And then on the next slide, slide 12, once we take temporary physical custody, the very next business day, all the facts of how we reviewed why we took temporary physical custody is presented at intake court. So again, this is not a step, this is not a roadblock, this is the legal process that must occur. So the court commissioner reviews everything that we've done. We go into court to verbally tell the court commissioner what's going on. Juvenile court intake shows up as well to explain why they granted our request for temporary physical custody. And the court commissioner finds those two middle bullets in that column. The court makes a finding that continuation of the child in the home is contrary to the child's welfare, and the court makes a finding that reasonable efforts to prevent removal of the child were made by us. Those are two legal findings. That's why I put those words in there. The court is saying, to their judgment, in their judgment, that we are legally okay to have these kids in foster care or relative care. Because you remember, once we've taken kids away from their parents, legally, they're not in their home, period. And the parents now have to be, we have to schedule visits for the kids, but that visit could be once a week for an hour. The kids are not in the home. So that's a big step. So you have to have legal authority to do that. It is not someone's one person's. So by now you have the initial assessment workers felt it's unsafe, their supervisor felt it's unsafe, JCI has granted us temporary physical custody, and now a court commissioner has affirmed all those decisions. And it's a legal decision. And the court sets another date then.
Is the parent there at all during the process?
Okay. Yeah. And often the parents are not happy about this. And they think that we are wrong.
And they're able to speak their case.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, we're not putting kids in foster care because dad spanked his oldest son on the bottom with his hand. Kids are going into foster care because they have been severely harmed. I mean, we're talking about infants with a broken leg. Infants don't get a broken leg. You can't break it. Infants don't run. Right? If you're not running, if you're not cruising, you shouldn't be bruising, is what the medical personnel say. Meaning like a 6-month-old, they shouldn't be getting a bruise, right? So this is not someone who's just upset or we're taking action, because these are kids that there's a, you know, like a big palm mark on their face, and a kid's alleging that dad, or belt loop marks on their back or belt loop marks on their butt because someone's been hitting them with the buckle end of a belt, and discipline that went way too far. May have started as discipline, but it's really crossed over to abuse. Yeah. And then as this work is going on, once these kids are in care, under initial assessment, work continues. So we now are on a real tight time frame. We have 48 hours to 72 hours to either say that we don't have enough for this to go forward in court, or if we gather everything we have at that time and we prepare all that documentation and we are sending it to the district attorney's office to tell them, we believe these children are in need of protection or services. We believe that one of these children may have been abused. We believe the other children are at risk of abuse or neglect. We turn over all of the documentation we have at that time to the DA's office. We do what we call a petition request. And then another person, another partner, has to step up. And it's not, again, it's not a roadblock. It's a member of our team doing their specific job. And the DA's job is to take these facts and craft it into a legal document called a petition. So if you go to slide 13, now you have another court date. That's usually 48 to 72 hours from that initial hearing. And everyone's got an attorney now. The young children are given a guardian ad litem. Each parent is given an attorney. Older children, 12 and up, are given a public defender. We do not have an attorney, but the district attorney is there representing the county and, in a sense, representing us. And they are coming to court and they're saying, here, court commissioner, this is what we believe is going on. These are why these kids are in need of protection or services. And the court commissioner is saying, yes, I accept the petition. There are legal grounds here. I should accept this. We're going to schedule another court date to determine if these kids are actually in need of protection or services. But the temporary physical custody order that I set 48 hours ago or 72 hours ago is still in effect. So parents, you cannot have your kids back. And they often at this hearing, if parents haven't visited their kids yet, we're getting the rules around visitation. General rule is parents are allowed to see their kids at a minimum once a week, and it's supervised in a supervised setting. If we can do more than that, at times we will. And with younger children, it's good to have more contact than that. And then they're setting another date. And so now it's in the court process. And now everything we're doing is being reviewed by the court commissioner and eventually by the judge. So now you have a DA reviewing our work, you have a judge or court commissioner reviewing our work, and everyone is agreeing with us that these kids were in need of help. Yeah.
So if there's a clear and present danger to children and they need to be removed immediately and you don't have a placement for them, where do they go?
They go, we find a placement for them.
But I mean, like, in that few hours' time, you're still
so far, we always find a placement for them, maybe not that hour, but before the night is over. Yeah. We've had one child in the last year that had to sleep in an office at our after-hours Child Protective Service Support Program through KIDS. We find a relative, we find another foster home, we find somebody.
Do they spend time sitting in your car? Or no. In the law enforcement car, or in an office waiting for a placement?
Well, I just answered that.
But I mean, you don't always have a placement ready to go.
Well, no, but no one would.
Right, so I guess I'm curious, from the experience of the child, what's happening?
Well, they're...
Someone comes to their house.
Yeah, no, they're...
I'm not saying any of this is wrong. I'm just
trying
to
understand. No, they're
going
into someone's car, and they're probably, if it's during the daytime hours, they're coming back to our building.
Okay.
And we have them in a conference room or a family interaction room where we have toys and things. One of our staff is watching them. We're getting them lunch. We're getting them, we're trying to get a game going or something for them to do that. If it's at night, they're at Child Protective Services through Kenosha and Development Services, and they're there until the foster home agrees to accept them. And so then we're either taking the kids to that foster home, or if it's a foster home, and because they're licensed and we know them, the foster parents could pick them up as well. But if with a relative home where we've done all the background checks, we're going to get out to that home then the night they accept those kids, so we can eyeball the home.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of detail we're all kind of curious about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, how does it unfold for the child in terms of trauma?
Yeah.
You know, is it a traumatic experience? What are they remembering about it as they go on through life? You know, like, was it good? Was it bad? Was it scary? Was it not so bad? You know, I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, I think the good questions. So the biggest thing to think about is when you place kids into foster care or relative care, there's always some trauma with that. It's secondary trauma. So what you're making is a professional judgment that
one is better than the other.
It's better than the trauma of being in an abusive or neglectful situation. Did that answer? Did the timeline answer your question, Supervisor?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm looking at the clock, and I'll try to maybe speed us up a little bit. Oh, let's go to slide 14 real quick. So we're going to, at the conclusion of the initial assessment, we're going to determine, was a child maltreated? Who is the maltreater? We call that, we substantiate child maltreatment. We name a maltreater. We want to, again, talk about adult functioning parenting practices. The biggest bullet there is, so if someone left, using a child being left home alone as an example, let's use that as a simple example. What are the safety threats with that? So a toddler, let's pretend, is left home alone. A neighbor calls at 7 o'clock at night, right? The parent is working. The parent thought their sister was coming over to babysit, and the sister and the parent actually spoke that evening, and they're involved, and some reason that sister left. We don't know during the initial assessment. So that parent may have a lot of protective capacities. We may be involved in this, but this may be a case that we don't need to be involved in very long. Maybe this was just really some miscommunication, or maybe the sister is not a very responsible person. Now, the parent should have known that, right? But we will work with that. That's a very different safety threat than the parent going to the bar at 7 o'clock at night after they put their two-year-old to bed and thinks the two-year-old can be left home alone sleeping while they go out for 3 or 4 hours. That's a totally different safety threat. It may show that the parent has an impending danger of alcoholism or drug addiction because they just needed to drink. It certainly shows that they don't have any parenting understanding of basic parenting skills, and they don't know enough about child development. You don't leave a two-year-old home alone, period. You just don't. So that's what is happening with the initial assessment. That's why we're gathering all that, to try to get a better sense of what is the underlying cause to the presenting injury or problem. And then we always discuss with the what the safety assessment analysis plan is. Number 15, I'll skip that, except to say, by the 60th day, this case is being transferred to the social worker who will have this case now for the rest of its life. And so the initial assessment worker is getting everything wrapped up within 60 days. The court process is going, and now they have a staffing. And often the ongoing worker is already knows the child, may have shown up at some of the court hearings, but once all the initial assessment work is completed correctly and documented, the ongoing worker, it's their case, they become the primary worker. So they have to get a full staffing with the ongoing supervisor there about everything that was uncovered in the initial assessment, plus they read it all. They read the initial assessment. So that's where the case switches. And now if you look at page 16, just to real highlight this, this gives us all the rules of the family interaction plan. So parents have to see their children at a minimum weekly. There's a separate plan in the case record for parents to follow. Supervised visits are literally parents seeing their kids in a room run by Children's Wisconsin, where an adult is in the room the entire hour and a half they're visiting. Monitored visits could be in that same building, But the adult who's, if visits are going well 6-7 months from now, instead of being in the room the entire visit, maybe that adult is coming in for half the visit, monitoring how the visit's going. Yeah.
Are phone calls, video calls between the parent and the child, are those controlled at all, or is that allowed, disallowed?
They're certainly allowed, and they're controlled in the sense that if they're going well, and we would ask probably like a foster parent to help monitor that, as opposed to, you know, a social worker being there.
So it's not like banned, but it's up to the foster parent how much of that to allow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we have to hear how they're going, right? You know, I mean, you want the parent to be supportive of the kid being in care, and not saying things that are going to be traumatic to the child that are unrealistic. Like, you don't want a parent saying, you'll be home tomorrow, right? Because that child won't be home tomorrow, because we're in an entire court process now, and that's not going to move that quickly. The other thing that under additional requirements is parents are required to see their children, and they must be allowed to see their children. So both sides. We want parents to see their children, but even if parents aren't doing a lot of work or doing the work they need to become safe parents, they're still allowed to see their children. Mm-hmm. Even if parents are doing almost nothing, as long as they're not a safety threat to their child during the visit. So you can't prohibit visits just because a parent isn't doing much of the work they need to do, okay? So I think what I'll just, because of time, and I know everyone's got a lot going on, the ongoing worker is going to meet with that parent to do a deeper assessment, gather what we call a social history, learn more about what that parent's life was like as a child, what was their home life like, whatever this parent's self-reporting. They're going to see the kids, talk to the caregivers of the kids. If you have, four children in a family, it's highly unlikely that they'd all be placed in the same foster home. So you're probably in two different homes. You're going to talk to each of the caregivers of those kids, see the kids. What are the service needs for those kids? What do they need to improve their well-being? Are there services we could be putting in for those children right now? Does the person who's providing care for the kids, the relative or the foster parent, have some concerns about one of the child, or their behavior sort of hard to manage? What can we do to support that foster parent? And then the last, the other part of it is, we can offer services to the parent, and we would love to have them start services early. Very often they don't. Very often they're not at a place yet. They're still sort of fighting everything. They've got, depending on their public defender, if their public defender's attitude is, I'll fight for whatever you want, and the parent is saying, well, I want my kids home tomorrow and I didn't do anything, then the public defender will sort of argue that in court. And really all that does is delay this. It is really rare that kids are in foster care that shouldn't be in foster care. That almost never happens. In our view, it never happens, you know? But it almost never happens in court, where the court says, no, you made a mistake, you know? That is so rare.
Before we leave that,
yeah.
If there's an issue in the foster home where they're doing this assessment after the child's there, does the foster home have an opportunity to correct that? Or are they quickly deemed unfit?
No, they have a chance to correct it. One of our programs is called Foster Home Support. So we have some kids that have really been affected by trauma in their biological home, whose behavior is really difficult. And so we can offer a social worker through community impact programs, actually professional services group, I misspeak, who is a master's level therapist. And they can come into that foster home and work with the foster parent and the kid, either providing therapy to the child or just great parenting tips for the foster parent. So we'll do that. Where we've had trouble, where people have gotten in trouble in foster care, being a foster parent, is if they out and out say, well, I'm not going to bring the child to visits with their parent. They cannot say that. They cannot opt out of that. That is part of being a foster parent. And we have sort of an old-fashioned way of viewing this. And I believe foster parents are parents. And so parents take their kids places. And so if you have a foster child in your home, part of being that foster parent is you have to provide transportation. Because those visits are not going to happen in the foster parent's house, mm-hmm. right. at least at the start of the case. And some of our biological parents don't have the ability to drive or they take the bus. So the visits have to go be somewhere else. So we've had that, yeah. Does that help?
I was thinking more of some of the requirements of the home and the structure of it that, you know, as you're visiting there.
That needs to be open.
We can't do that.
Okay.
As you're visiting there, you're noticing something, you know, like there's a fire escape plan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and there's something in the way of that.
No, we correct that. Okay. I mean, if they get licensed as a foster parent, we want to correct that. We don't want to just, we need foster parents.
Yeah.
So to get through the licensing process, they're going to comply with all the rules. They're going to follow the rules. We license, you had a question about that. We license the person as a foster parent, and we license the physical home. So the person has to be a fine, upstanding person. We do like a social history on them, and they have to pass all the background checks. And then their physical space has to be big enough for how many kids we have in the home.
A question that comes to mind related to what Supervisor Stocker said was, what if that temporary placement is with another family member and not a licensed foster parent?
Yes.
Do you find a problem with that person or location?
Well, it shouldn't be a physical problem. We've eyeballed the home, so that mm-hmm. part is good. If it's a relative and suddenly we found that we learn more about them and they're not a safe person, then we're going to move that kid that day.
And you can move them right away?
Yeah, yeah.
No immediately. Process. To, okay.
We'll do an emergency change of placement.
I think
we have the authority
happens.
To do that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
So if we were wrong, and there's something about that relative that is not correct, meaning could impact child safety, then we can move them immediately.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think what I'll do is on slide 18 quickly. So we are at 60 days, and the case is transferred to the ongoing unit. We might be 4 months later now. We might be at the 6 month mark. We could be at the 4.5 month mark from when the child left their home. Another 2.5 months later. Could be 3 months later. At some point in all these prior court hearings and rescheduling, the parents generally plead that their children are in need of protection or services. There's an agreement between the assistant district attorney and the public defender of the parents, and they set this over for disposition. It is very rare that this goes to trial. It could, and every once in a while it does, but I mean by once in a while, once or twice a year, a case might go to trial. We present to the report a very thorough dispositional court report where we are giving the social history of the parents, our analysis, and I'll look at the biggest bullets here would be services recommended, i.e. what services did this parent need to participate in, and those services recommended are tied to the last bullet, conditions of return, i.e. what is wrong, what's happened in this home that this is an unsafe home. So our professional belief is if you do these services and you show that you're using them and you're making changes in your behavior, then I would see that these things in the home should be changing. And that would be the conditions of return. Okay? Yeah.
When you make that list of whatever it is, if they complete 90%, is that acceptable or are you looking for 100%?
Ideally, we're looking for 100%, but they don't have to have 100% before the kids go home.
Okay.
Because we stay involved once the kids go home. And we stay involved for generally 9 months to a year. The work is not done when the kids go home. But it's up to the judge. So that's what I just said here. and what our staff would probably work. But it depends what that 90% is. Because if the 10% is that they're still testing positive for cocaine, then they're not, those kids aren't going home.
Sure.
Okay? Or if the 10% is they've never gone to the anger management class and they're still violent people, then they're not, those kids aren't going home either. So when you say 90-10 or 80-20, it really is specific to what the bigger problem is.
10% is weighted.
Weighted, could be weighted very heavily. Yes. So then on slide 19, at this point at disposition, the court is saying, yes, each child in the home is a home child in need of protection or services, CHIPS, that's the legal term on all the orders, CHIPS. The child is placed out of their home. So they've been placed out of their home this whole time.
Temporary
physical custody order. Now they have a dispositional order saying they are placed out of their home because it's contrary to the child's welfare to be at home. And we've provided reasonable efforts to prevent removal. The child's under court jurisdiction. The third bullet from at the very bottom, expiration of the order. Every child's on an order until they turn 18 or 19. That means right now at that hearing, the parents are hearing, your children will never go home until they're 18 or 19. And they're until you do something. And then the next slide, slide 20, talks about what they need to do. And these broad categories here of like maintaining a suitable residence, well, it isn't that simple. There's like five or six subcategories of each of these. So that would be, it has to be clean. You have to have your rent paid on time. You have to pay all your bills on time. It has to be appropriate for children to live there. You have to have all appropriate furnishings. All of that is spelled out in great detail under these conditions of return. They have to cooperate with us, actively participate in services. And then the bottom bullet there, this might be a sample of some of the services we're asking them to participate in. Random urine analysis. So literally, many of our biological parents have a phone number they have to call every day, Monday through Friday, to see if their color is up. And if their color is up, they have to go into the public health department and give a urine sample. And then we test that urine sample for drugs. And if alcohol is part of the problem, we test for drugs and alcohol. Some of the parents we meet with have really significant mental health issues. We're requiring them to get a full-blown psychological evaluation, follow through with treatment. There may be things that are more clear that we don't need a psychologist to tell us. You know, anger is an issue, maybe anger management classes, parenting education, individual therapy, and any of those things. And see your kids and be involved in your kids' care, and show up at your kids' doctor's appointments and things like that. So that's, and they're given a notice that if they don't do these things, they could lose the rights to their children forever. So that's another significant change about the ASFA language, is that it's safety, permanence, and well-being. So at this point in time now, the whole concept of permanence is out there, that you have to start actively making these changes. And if you do, and your home is safe, then your children can be returned to you. But if you're not making these changes and it's not going well, then we're going to find another safe place for those kids to grow up. And that could be through adoption or a guardianship. So that's really, and now, where is our timeline here? Because you have the meeting at 7:30.
Well, we have till 7:29.
All right, okay. So, how does everyone know if the court sets an order till 18-19? How does the court keep on top of this? They set on slide 21, they require us to draft a permanency plan for each child in out-of-home care. That's like a case plan.
Mm-hmm.
The permanency plan updates how the kids are doing in foster care, what services they're getting. It updates what are the parents doing on their conditions of return, what services they're doing, and you know, how our visits going and everything. So in that permanency plan, if we have a parent that's a drug abusing parent and they are dropping urine analysis and they're testing positive for cocaine, heroin, pot, anything, we're going to list all that in the permanency plan, or we're going to list that, you know, they've dropped once a week for the last 6 months and everyone was clean. If they don't show up for a urine analysis, it's considered a positive for drugs or alcohol. So they have to show up, period. There really are no excuses. It's that simple. If the parents have a drug or alcohol problem, they need to be involved in treatment. So that might be a specific service they're involved in. That permanency plan is going to detail then when did they get involved. And we're keeping on tabs of what is the parent actually doing in treatment, meaning we have releases of information, we're talking to the therapist, and we're getting the results. Are they actively participating? Are they really sharing in that? Do they appear to be on the road to recovery? Or are they just sort of paying lip service to it and missing half the appointments? And then we're looking at that and the urine analysis to see if they're really tackling that problem. Same with parenting. We're giving them like a parenting education, anything from a classroom to a parent mentor that is working with them one-on-one in their home. And we're talking to that parent mentor. Are they actively participating? Are you seeing them use these new skills when they visit their kids? Are we seeing them do it? And so it isn't just going through the motions or checking it off. That's one thing I've heard people say, are they checking off the boxes? Well, they have to start by checking a box, but we need to see real change. We need to see behavioral change that we can observe and measure. And by measuring, I mean that all the other professionals are saying, yes, I believe they really are working on this. So that's where, slide 22 really talks about the work we have, the services we're putting in. And if it's going well, what you're seeing is you're seeing the parent not be evasive with services, but is actively participating. You're seeing the worker, when they call the providers, and they're checking with them weekly or monthly, depending on what type of service it is, are the parents really providing that? You're going out to the parent's home, it looks like they're getting, this home looks more presentable, looks cleaner. Parents who maybe weren't working or had sort of lousy jobs or just sketchy jobs have found a better job and are staying employed. We literally ask parents, we need people to print off pay stubs. And, you know, you say you're working here 8 to 5. Okay, let me see a pay stub that says 40 hours a week that you've worked there at this place that you said you're working at. We don't just take anyone's word for that.
What's the method of contact to get that information? Or is it phone sometimes?
Yeah, we have to get release of information for every, you know, we have a lot of releases.
But no, but when you're making contact with the parent.
We're going out to see the parent at least face-to-face monthly,
okay.
Once a month.
That's a face-to-face.
But a lot of our parents, if they're, you know, we have parents, but we also have more contact than that.
Yeah.
Because parents, they don't do a lot of talking on the phone, much more texting, actually, or some parents are good at emailing, too. It's interesting. It's just the way of the world now, you know.
As long as there's a contact.
Yeah, yeah. But we're doing all that, and then if you look at the client progress, you know, parents, like in the bullets there, the providers that we're working with are documenting progress. Urines, and we drop a lot of urine in the Division of Children and Family Services. We have a budget item of $110,000 we spend on urine analysis every year. That's how big of an issue that is for the parents we work with. And so,
does that continue during this time?
Yes.
If that
goes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So on slide 23, we're back in court. We're doing the permanency plan reviews. The judge is reviewing that at a hearing. Our judges are great. They want these cases back in court every 6 months. Historically, they don't have to do that. They could have a citizen panel review these cases one 6 month period and they just get it back in court once a year. But our judges they agreed on this years ago. It was Judge Kirkman and Judge Rozelle. They said, no, we want these cases back in court. Because again, it's not an obstacle. It is another party that is reviewing this to see if everything is working correctly. And if the judges don't like what they see, or they think we should be doing more at those hearings, they say, okay, division, you need to do something else, you know? The parent is telling me that this service that you tried to start, they don't like this provider, they don't think this person, it connects with them. I want you to try a different parenting program, and we'll do it because the judge is ordering us to do that. Or because, you know, to be honest, we all have choices, right? And there is truth to that. We don't always connect with the same medical doctor. We've probably all had times where we've changed a physician or something because we didn't feel we had a good connection. So that goes on. And slide 24, during this process, very quickly, the social workers are not making these decisions alone. Every social worker is required to do weekly supervision with their supervisor. Each unit has a weekly unit meeting talking about broad, more policy issues. All significant casework requires a supervisor's approval. By significant, meaning services that are going to start that we have to spend money on, supervisor has to approve. Decisions about children going home or coming out of care, supervisor is going to approve. Other unusual circumstances in a case, changing visitation and expanding it greatly, a supervisor is going to weigh in on that. And then we have three, formal case consultation is available to all of our county social workers. We have three primary areas, case planning and review, the transition team and district attorney staffings. Case planning and review is just case consultation. We have psychologists, one psychologist on that panel and very experienced people in the human services field to bring over cases that you're feeling stuck with. Spend 45 minutes, get some new, fresh ideas. Transition team, that's a team that looks at the cases that are reunifying specifically. So the cases that I've been talking the majority about right now. Those cases, they're in a program called Intensive Aftercare Reunification Program, and that team staffs these cases every other month generally, sometimes more soon. And then district attorney staffings, those are the cases where parents aren't making progress and it may be going towards adoption. So, real quick, I'll let you look at this on your own slides, 25 and 26, list all of the different services we provide. We have to provide these because we have people with all different issues, and we can provide therapy in the home, out of the home, safety services, special programs for kids with special needs, but we're doing all of that to make a safe home so those parents can make the changes they need to become safe parents. And on slide 27, what you really talk about is now you could be a year out from when those kids were removed from their home, you could be a year and a half out. But there's been progress. Things are going forward. So we've left visitation in that room where someone's in the room watching every minute of it. We've gone to monitored. We've likely now are moving to visits in the parent's home. And the Intensive Aftercare Reunification Program, we call it IAP, IAP, is going out doing random checks on that. They are just popping in. The parents are visiting maybe Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon. No overnights yet. The IAP program is literally dropping in unannounced, staying for a while, dropping in twice unannounced each day. How are the kids? What does the home look like? Is the parent engaged with them? And they're not coming in there like to catch them doing something wrong. They're coming in there supportive, but they also are going there to be eyes and ears. So that if some of the issues that we were concerned about, drug use, anything like that, they're looking for all of that. Any signs of illegal drug use. Maybe the boyfriend was the main abuser, and we want to make sure that the mother is no longer connected to that man. Are there signs of him in the house? And so that, and then as that's going on, they're still dropping urine analysis, so think about that. They've been dropping urine analysis now for a year and a half, maybe once a week, okay? So we have all these urines that don't have drugs in them. And then they're still working maybe in therapy, or they're doing all this other work. So all of this is going on simultaneously, and the case manager is keeping tabs of all of that, monitoring it, and at times bringing different providers together for team meetings with the parent to chart progress. So as that goes on, at some point, visits include some overnights because the parents are making all this progress. And again, overnights that we're checking after supper, we're checking at 8 o'clock at night to see if the kid, are these kids getting into a bedtime routine? Are the parents getting them up in the morning, getting them to school on time if it's during the work week? Mm-hmm. And then at some point, the IA worker, or not, the ongoing worker, excuse me, and their supervisor say, we can move towards reunification. And then we have to get permission from the court to do that. So then on slide 28, one way we can do that is we can file a document called trial reunification. And literally, if the court doesn't object within a 10-day window, or nobody else objects, because it's a notice, goes out to all the parties, including the district attorney, including the guardian ad litem, all those people, then that 10-day window closes, the kids literally go home. But they're still under court jurisdiction, and it's a 90-day trial reunification. And during that time, we're monitoring them daily. We have the intensive aftercare reunification program is out at the home every day, normally, at the start of that. And if it's going well and everything else is still progressing, we schedule a court hearing, and then the judge reviews that progress, and then we're going and recommending full reunification. And then at that time, the judge is in agreement. Boom, again, not another obstacle, another person making a decision. Legally then, those kids are returned home. But our order almost always continues. None of the judges just say, you're done.
You're done.
So normally, it used to be standard that it was always in a year. Now with the trial reunification taking 90 days, sometimes they'll order just for 9 months because in the judge's mind, they've already been 3 months at home. And so there's still an order on these children. Services are often still continuing. Maybe some of the intense services have become less intense. Intensive aftercare reunification is still monitoring this. Our worker is seeing that family in the home at least twice a month, if not more frequently, and checking on everything. And we're real proud of this fact. When this wraps up, these families rarely come back. I won't say that no family ever, there's one or two, unfortunately, that do come back, but generally, when we reunify and we've done all this work, they're done. So what this looks like then is those kids, in the example I've been using, they may have been out of the home for 18 months, but they were making such progress that no one's thinking of terminating parental rights. And then we're monitoring them again for another year. So we've known these family and these kids for 2.5 years. And then we close.
What is the ratio of TPR to reunification in the county?
That's a great question. When I do the annual report, we reunify at a higher rate than TPR. But there's some youth justice numbers. The way the state measures it, we usually reunify at about, I think, 68% last year. I don't know what this year's was.
And what's the TPR?
That can be 20-some percent of those cases, yeah. And then there's a very small percentage of guardianships. We don't do that very much. And there's always some kids that do age out of foster care. We really don't like that. We do everything we can to prevent that. But that's become rarer and rarer, yeah. And then, I know we don't have a lot of time, and I won't go into all that level of detail, but the next couple of slides talk about 29, termination of parental rights. So we'll go to the next one, 30. The big thing is it's another whole court process. So when we staff with the district attorney, they are giving us really advice. They're saying, okay, the parents aren't doing everything, but I need you to do a few more attempts to see if they can get on board. Or I need you to check to make sure there aren't any relatives in this other state that really are interested. So we work together. The hearings start, a new set of attorneys are appointed to the parents. The big thing everyone needs to remember is while we're going through a termination of parental rights, the parents are still visiting their kids, and all those services that I just had two pages of services, we can't end any of them, okay? We have to keep offering those services. That court process can take 6 months. And at the end of it, the court will almost always rule in our favor. Sometimes parents can take it to a trial. It could be a trial in front of a judge, and then the judge is like the jury. Or it can be a trial in front of citizens. And then the court's going to rule that there are grounds to terminate parental rights and that it's in the best interest of the children to do that. What we've done, though, is that we were concurrent planning. So slides ago, I talked about concurrent planning. So when things aren't going well, we're finding that pre-adoptive home for those kids, not now at the TPR, but we found that a year ago. And we found that relative, if the foster parents say, I don't want to adopt, okay, then we're going to look for somebody who is willing to take these kids in and move those children to a pre-adoptive home. And then someone who's willing to do that. Now, often that's a big commitment, so people aren't ready to do that right away. But they're in a pre-adoptive home. The termination of parental rights goes through guardianship. All the responsibility for the case turns to the state of Wisconsin. And then they assign a new worker to just complete the adoption, which is like they do an adoption study, and they have to file all the documentation, and they get it into the court. And that could be another 2 to 3 months later before the adoption is finalized.
Yeah.
And if the parents appeal the termination of parental rights, it can get hung up for another month or two while that goes through that process. They usually don't win. We had a court of appeals overturned it, and it was really on a technicality in the hearings. So those kids are going to get adopted. We're convinced of that, but we have the case back now, and we're going to have to go back and do it again. The court, not the county social worker. There was just something they didn't quite do technically correct, and the appeals court overturned it. But those kids will eventually get adopted.
Very, very quickly.
Yep.
We talked about in our human services budget meeting back in the fall about this rule change, or that was a state thing that we were doing, and the state said, no, you're doing it wrong.
Yes.
Having the hearings on the same day. That was the placement and child support?
Yeah, we used to get we used to have child support brought into these orders that are in the Child Protective Services world, the CHIPS orders. And now we have to order the parents to cooperate with the county child support agency and follow through with the rulings of in family court.
What's the reasoning behind these things can't happen on the same day?
You can find out now that you're elected.
I've been trying to find out. Trying to find out for months. No one can give me an answer.
I don't mean that silly.
They felt
that it was not legal, that it should be its own separate action in the family court world. And that was, and they're the state, so the state said that's the way it should be.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Okay.
Yes.
I would just like to say you and your staff do a great job.
Oh, thank you.
From my 15 years with the county, you have been a jewel for the county. And just keep up the good work. I think you guys do a great job.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for the very, very, very thorough. This was what you needed. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I will ditto those comments as well. I appreciate you putting all that together. It was very informative to see how it all is laid out. I guess my question to you, the answer will have to come at another time, I'm guessing, but in your professional opinion, does this process work well? Are there roadblocks? Are there inefficiencies
that
at the county or the state level could be changed that would make it better for the kids? That's kind of what I'm curious about.
The casework, if we want to talk about the TPR process, that would be a separate conversation.
Okay.
There's probably some things that the state could look at. But as far as the work we are with are we keeping kids safe from abuse and neglect? Yes. Are we improving their well-being? Yes. Do Do all of our partners work well together to find permanent safe homes? Yes. So I think at the county level, we work incredibly well together.
Okay.
And those, the partnerships that I've talked about, DCFS, Juvenile Court Intake, District Attorney's Office, our service providers, our Child Advocacy Center, and the area hospitals and the school district, where we all work together extremely. And so that's, you should be proud of that.
Yeah, that sounds great. I just, yeah, if there's something that's not, or that's slowing things down, that's what I would be interested to know. But
that'd
sounds
be a
like
different
it,
discussion longer about that. There's probably things that could be done when parents are not making progress and children have to find a permanent home through adoption. There's area there that could probably
be continued.
Yeah, that's okay. I would love to hear that.
Thanks so much. Thanks for your attention.
Follow up on the side.
Appreciate
the permanency plan hearing. Are foster parents allowed to participate?
Yes, they are. And every judge handles that differently. Some judges are great about calling on foster parents. Some judges are not.
Okay.
But they are notified of it, and they are allowed to be there.
But they're not necessarily allowed to participate.
No, don't say that. They're allowed to be there. They're allowed to be there. I'm just being honest with you.
Okay.
Certain judges are...
Are not willing to let
them...
Okay, I'm trying
the hearing to... The hearing may be just flying by, and the judge forgets to.
Okay.
You know, it could be as simple as that.
Okay.
But they all are welcome to.
Is there a way for the foster parents to say, hey...
Okay.
Hey, I have something to say, or...
Yeah, they can raise their hand.
Okay.
They can also submit, when they get a notice, they can submit their comments in writing.
Okay.
Okay,
that's great.
Yeah,
that's...
and the courts are all back in person in Kenosha. So foster parents have to be willing to show up at, 1:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah, that's
And some for many of them that's a hardship, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're not. We don't really have much virtual court anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks for all your questions. I appreciate it.
I had 2.5 pages of questions, and you answered them as we most
good.
Of my was so that.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Good. Great. Then I'm getting to know you better. Then good. All right.